means Creole mustard, an excellent native mustard, I met Barbara Pierre. I had just come out of Dugas' grocery with 4 jars of Zatarain's, and we almost collided on the sidewalk. She said, "You're not from St. Montville, are you? You can't be." "I'm from Missouri."
"What in the world are you doing here? Got a little Huck Finn in you?"
"Just follow the bayou. Now I'm looking for the Ford Agency."
"Coincidences? I work there. I'll show you the way."
She was a secretary at the agency and took classes at the University of Southwestern Louisiana in Lafayette when she could. I asked about St. Martinville, but she had to start working before we could say much. "Here's an idea," she said. "Come by at noon, and we can have lunch at my place. I live in the project on the other side of the bayou." I picked her up at 12. She asked about the trip, especially about Selma, and how things were as I saw them. A white man griped about changes, and a black said there weren't enough changes to gripe about.
"That's us, too. What we want is slow coming, if it's coming at all. Older blacks here are scared of whites and won't do much for change if it means risk. Others don't care, as long as everything gets smothered over with politeness by whites. Young blacks see the hypocrisy, even when it's not there. But too many of them are duped on drugs, and that's what some of this town wants us."
"Don't any whites here try to help?"
"A few, but if a white starts helping too much, they get cut off or shut down by the others and end up paying almost the price we do. Sure, we got good whites, when they're not scared out of showing sympathy."
On Margaret Street, she pointed to her apartment in a small one-story brick building. Standard federal housing. As we went to the door, a shadowy face watched from behind a chintz curtain in another apartment. "See that? Could be the start of bad news," she said. "Maybe I should leave. I don't want to cause trouble for you."
"Too late. Besides, I live my own life here. I won't be pushed. But it'll come back in some little way. Smart remark, snub. One old white lady kicks me at the library. Swings her feet under the table because she doesn't want my kind in there. I could break her in two, she's so frail. She'll be kicking like a heifer if she gets wind of this."
Barbara Pierre's apartment was a tidy place, but for books on the sofa. "You can see I still use the library even with the nuisances. The kicking bitch hides books I return so I get overdue notices and have to go prove I turned the book in. I explain what's going on, but nothing changes. Simplest thing is trouble."
"That's what I heard in Selma."
"I'm not alone, but sometimes it seems like a conspiracy, especially in little towns. Gossip and bigotry, that's the blood and guts."
"Was that person who just looked out the window white?"
"Are you crazy? Nobody on this end of Margaret Street is white. That's what I mean about us blacks not working together. Half this town is black, and we've only got one elected black official. Excuse my language, but for all the good he does this side of the bayou, he's one useless black mofo."
"Why don't you do something? I mean, you, personally."
"I do. And when I do, I get both sides coming down on me, including my own family. Everywhere I go, sooner or later, I'm in the courtroom. Duplicity. That's my burning pot. I've torn up more than one court of law."
We sat down at her small table. A copy of Catch-22 lay open. "Something that happened a few years ago keeps coming back on me. When I was living in Norristown, outside Philadelphia, I gained a lot of weight and went to a doctor. She gave me some diet pills, but never explained they were basically speed, and I developed a minor drug problem. I went to the hospital, and the nuns said if I didn't sign certain papers, they couldn't admit me. So I signed, and they put me in a psychiatric ward. Took 2 hellish weeks to prove I didn't belong there. God, it's easy to get somebody adjudicated crazy."
"Adjudicated?"
"You don't know the word, or you didn't think I knew it?"
"It's the right word. Go on."
"So now, because I tried to lose 30 pounds, people do a job on my personality. But if I shut up long enough, things quiet down. Still, it's the old pattern. Any nigger you can't control is crazy."
As we ate our sandwiches and drank Bark's root beer, she asked whether I had been through Natchitoches. I said I hadn't.
They used to have a statue up there on the main street called the Good Darkie Statue. It was an old black man, slouched shoulders, big possum-eating smile, tipping his hat. A few years ago, blacks made them take it down. Whites couldn't understand. Couldn't see the duplicity in that statue. Duplicity on both sides. God almighty. I'll promise them one thing. I ain't gonna be no more gentle darkies crooning down on the levee.
I smiled at her mammy imitation, but she shook her head.
In the 60s, I wanted that statue blown to bits. It started in Baton Rouge, now at LSU, but they put it in the wrong building. Ought to be in the Capitol, reminding people. Preserve it so nobody forgets. Forgives, okay, but not forgets.
Were things bad when you were a child?
Strange thing. I was born here in 41 and grew up here, but I don't remember prejudice. My childhood was warm and happy, especially when I was reading. Maybe I was too young to see, I don't know. I go on about the town, but I love it. I've put my time in the cities, New Orleans, Philly. Your worst southern cracker is better than a northern liberal, when it comes to duplicity anyway, because you know right off where the cracker crumbles. With a northerner, you don't know until it counts, and that's when you get a job done on yourself.
I'd rather see a person shut up about his prejudices.
You haven't been deceived. Take my job. I was pleased to get it. Thought it was a breakthrough for me and other blacks here. Been there 3 weeks, and next Wednesday is my last day.
What happened?
Duplicity's what happened. White man in the shop developed a bad back, so they moved him inside. His seniority gets my job. I see the plot. Somebody in the company got pressured to get rid of me.
Are you going to leave town?
I'm staying. That's my point. I'll take St. Martinville over what I've seen of other places. I'm staying here to build a life for myself and my son. I'll get married again, put things together.
She got up and went to the window.
I don't know. Maybe I'm too hard on the town. In an underhanded way, things work here. Mostly because old blacks know how to get along with whites. So they're good darkies. They own their own homes. They don't live in a rat-ass ghetto. There's contentment. Roots versus disorder.
She stopped abruptly and smiled.
Even German soldiers they put in the POW camp here to work the cane fields wanted to stay on.
We cleared the table and went to the front room. A wall plaque. O Lord, help me this day to keep my big mouth shut. On a bookshelf by the window was the 2-volume microprint edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, the one sold with a magnifying glass.
I love it, she said. Book of the Month Club special, $17.50. Haven't finished paying for it, though.
Is it the only one in town?
Doubt it. We got brains here. After the aristocracy left Paris during the French Revolution, a lot of them settled in St. Martinville, and we got known as Le Petit Paris. Can you believe this little place was a cultural center, only second to New Orleans? Town started slipping when the railroad put the Bayou steamers out of business. But the church is proof of what we had. When you finish the college courses, what then? I'd like to teach elementary school. If I can't teach, I want to be a teacher's aide. But, here's a big but. If I can make a living, I'll write books for children. We need black women writing, and my courses are in journalism and French. Whatever happens, I hope they don't waste my intelligence.
She went to wash up. I pulled out one of her books, El Señor Presidente, by Guatemalan novelist Miguel Asturias. At page 85, she had underlined 2 sentences. The chief thing is to gain time. We must be patient. On the way back to the agency, she said,
I'll tell you something that took me a long time to figure out, but I know how to end race problems.
Is this a joke?
Might as well be. Find a way to make people get bored with hating instead of helping. Simple.
She laughed.
That's what it boils down to.
14. The Corps of Engineers calls it the Atchafalaya Basin Floodway System. Some Acadians call it a boondoggle in the boondocks. The Atchafalaya River, only 135 miles long, has an average discharge more than twice as great as that of the Missouri River, although the area it drains is less than a fifth of the Missouri's, and the Big Money is nearly 20 times as long. Yet the Atchafalaya forms the biggest river basin swamp in North America. And before it became an overflow drain, its swamp was at least as biologically rich and varied as the Everglades. Maybe it still is, despite claims by older Cajuns that wildlife isn't what it was a generation ago. Nevertheless, some ornithologists believe the swamp might hold the last ivory-billed woodpecker. After the Great Flood of 1927, the Corps built hundreds of miles of protection levees around the upper Atchafalaya and down the length of the basin to create an emergency discharge route for the Mississippi and Red Rivers. The Corps said had it done nothing to the Atchafalaya, the Mississippi, always trying to change course, would eventually open a new channel about 60 miles north of St. Martinville and leave New Orleans on a backwater oxbow. The problem is that engineers built so injudiciously, the swamp is filling with some of the 1 million tons of silt the big rivers carry in daily, and those Cajuns who traditionally make a living from the wetlands by fishing, frogging, mud-bugging, trapping, and moss-picking are having to leave their fastness and take work in industry. The Corps altered not just the Atchafalaya and a great swamp, but also one of the distinctive ethnic peoples in America. Maybe the swamp is doomed anyway, what with bayous being dredged and channels dug so oil and gas drilling equipment can get in, what with pipelines being laid and wipe-out logging of Cypress and Tupelo. To be sure, dry land farmers, a minority, are happy. At the north end of the basin, they have cleared 60,000 acres of swamp hardwoods for pasturage and soybeans. Now, to rectify their errors, the Corps wants permanent control of the basin. And of all things, many environmentalists support the plan. Everyone believes what the dredge and bulldozer can do, they can also undo. But a Cajun named Cassie Hébert told me he had yet to see a bush hog make a mink. Some Cajuns believe in only one thing, the Mississippi. Hébert said, "The Atchafalaya is a shorter way to the Gulf than the Mississippi take. Big river gonna find us down here, Corps be damned. One day rain gonna start and keep on like it do sometimes. When the rain ain't stop, the Mississippi gonna be 90 miles west of New Orleans, and St. Martinville gonna be a seaport. And it won't be the firstest time the river go running from Lady New Orleans." Indian legend tells of a serpent of fabulous dimension living in the Atchafalaya Basin. When Chittimacha braves slew it, its writhing throes gouged out Bayou Teche. Tesh may be an Indian word for snake, and Cajuns say the big river will one day avenge the serpent. We have only to wait. The Teche, at the western edge of the basin and paralleling the Atchafalaya, has been spared the salvation wreaked on the river, even though before roads came, the Little Teche, not the Atchafalaya, was the highway from the Gulf into the heart of Louisiana. Half of the 18th century settlements in the state lay along or very near the Teche, St. Martinville, Lafayette, Opelousas, New Iberia. The Teche was navigable for more than 100 miles. Indians put dugouts on it. Spanish adventurers and French explorers floated it in cypress-trunk pirogues, some displacing 50 tons. Settlers rowed it in keelboats pulled by mules or slaves. Merchandise arrived by paddle-wheelers. And during the Civil War, Union gunboats came up the Teche to commandeer the fertile cane fields along its banks. All of this on a waterway no wider than the length of a war canoe, no deeper than a man, no swifter than mud turtles that swim it. Blue Road 31, from near Opelousas, follows the Teche through sugarcane, under cypress and live oak, into New Iberia. St. Martinville had dozed on the bayou for 200 years. Not so New Iberia. A long strip of highway businesses had cropped up to the west, and the town center by the little drawbridge was clean and bright. No dozing here. Bayou-side New Iberia gave a sense of both the new made old and the old made new. Contemporary architecture, interpreting earlier designs rather than imitating them. A restored classic revival mansion, shadows on the Tesh. A society whose members are 100-year-old live oaks, and the only 2nd-century 7-foot marble statue of the Emperor Hadrian in a savings and loan. New Iberia suggested Cajun history, but St. Martinville lived it. I took Louisiana 14. Roadsides of pink thistle, cemeteries jammed with above-ground tombs, cane fields under high smokestacks of sugar factories, then salt dome country, then shrimp trawlers at Delcom. My last chance at Cajun food was Abbeville, a town with 2 squares, one for the church, one for the courthouse. On the walk at Black's Oyster Bar, a chalked sign, "Fresh, topless, salty oysters." Inside, next to a stuffed baby alligator, hung an autographed photo of Paul Newman, who had brought the cast of The Drowning Pool to Black's while filming near Lafayette. Considering that a recommendation, I ordered a dozen topless on the half shell and a fried oyster loaf. Oysters and hot pepper garnish heaped between slices of French bread. Good enough to require a shrimp loaf for the road. On the highway, I wished the British had exiled more Acadians to America, if only for their cooking. Somewhere lives a bad Cajun cook, just as somewhere must live one last ivory-billed woodpecker. For me, I don't expect ever to encounter either one. The rice fields began near Kaplan, where the land is less than 20 feet above the sea, only 30 miles south, and kept going all the way to Texas. The Lake Arthur Bridge made a long, curvilinear glide into space as it rose above the water. Passage was like driving the chromium contours of Louisianan José de Rivera's famous Construction 8. At Lake Charles, another sinuous parabola of Bridgeway, an aerial thing curving about so I could see its underside as I went up. The city stretched below in a swelter of petrochemical plants and wharves. I got through only with effort and pressed north to State 27. When I had left home, I announced a stop sooner or later at a cousin's in Shreveport. I hoped for mail. U.S. 171 was traffic, fumes, heat, grim faces. I became a grim face and drove. Rosepine, Anacoco, Hornbeck, and Zwolle, alphabetically the last town in the Rand McNally Road Atlas. Abbeville, just south, is the first. A yellow simmer of glaring haze sat on Shreveport like a pot lid. I pulled in at a honky-tonk called Charlie's to telephone my cousin. No one home. I took a seat at the bar. Charlie's was built in spare time after bowling league construction. The ceiling so low I could almost touch them flat-footed. After 10 minutes, I regained my vision in the cool darkness. Near the bar hung one of those pictures of dogs playing poker and cheating in a multitude of cleverly canine ways. The west fire exit unexpectedly opened and sunlight poured in. Like Dracula's before the cross, we cried out and covered our eyes. Next to me, a lady, nearing her 7th decade, kept between us a white purse big enough for a mugger to hide in. She wore a black wig. Her devil-may-care red lipstick had come unhitched and slipped a notch. Her layers of nail polish were chipped like paint on an old dory, and her hands lay in 2 piles on the bar, the slack skin taken up by plumpness. As for the jungle gardenia perfume, it was only a question of time before tsetse flies hit. She reached over and lifted my can of Jack's as if to test the weight. Then she turned, saw me, and jumped.
"Oh, gracious, you've scared me. I'm sorry. I thought you went off and left your beer. Gracious."
"May I buy you one?"
"Oh, gracious, no. Beer does things to me. I just look after the girls."
"Are you related?"
"Goodness, no. Only a friend. I worry about them with these cowboys."
The girls were the bartender and a pool player, both of whom looked quite capable of handling any of the spin-stool cowboys. Shreveport is more Dallas than New Orleans. The bartender was, in the lingo, one tough broad. A snake fits its skin no tighter than she fit her blue jeans. The pool player, a woman of sleek legs, wore a tank top and cutoffs that had seen the absolute maximum of strategic cutting. The game she played was, nominally, eight ball, but the real purpose was to make spectacular shots, never mind if the cue ball ended up in someone's schlitz. After each shot, she groaned and took a long, hard stretch out of her hustler's crouch and said, "I can't shoot worth a damn today." Who had noticed her shooting, watching as we were her form? She kept a beer can on a stack of damp dollar bills. As lousy as she played, she managed to beat the Louisiana Cowboys, who laughed with beer commercial heartiness. They knew a good entertainment value when they saw it. The overripe lushness of Jungle Gardenia enveloped me again. "Who's your favorite picture show actor?" she said. "I don't know. Alan Bates? Jimmy Stewart? Chief Dan George?"
"Mine's Franch Otone."
There followed a long recital of movie titles, bits of plot, pieces of dialogue. As she talked, she laid a soft curl of fingers over my wrist. It wasn't a gesture of friendship so much as an ascertaining of my presence, a holding of her audience. Once she had heard that Mr. Tone wore a stomach corset in his later years, but she knew that couldn't have been true. The lady must have known more about Franch Otone than anyone else in the world. Whatever empty spaces had opened in her life, she filled with dreams of a flickering vision. As Jesus or Mozart or Crazy Horse, Phil Hollows and others, so Franch Otone had come to his lady moist in her jungle gardenia. I called my cousin again, got directions, and drove to her house. The sun was gone when the family sat down to dinner. A pair of heavy moths bumped the screen, and we took barbecued chicken from the platter. It had been a long time since I'd eaten among faces I'd seen before, and I knew it would be hard leaving. Part 4. South by Southwest. 1. From the Cherokee, there had been no letter. Now, under a low gray sky, Highway 79 stretched out like a dead snake. I watched the empty road and hated the solitude. The wanderer's danger is to find comfort. A weekend in Shreveport around friends and security had started to pull me into a warm thrall, to enfold me, to make the wish for the road a craziness. So it was only memory of times in strange places where the scent of the unknown is sharp that drew me onto the highway again. William Carlos Williams. Memory is a kind of accomplishment. Maybe. And maybe, too, in the end, it's the only thing one can call truly his own. Memory is each man's own last measure, and for some the only achievement. I crossed into Texas. I've heard Americans debate where the West begins. Texans say the Brazos River. In St. Louis, it's the Mississippi, and they built a very expensive gateway arch to prove it. Philadelphians say the Alleghenies. In Brooklyn, it's the Hudson, and on Beacon Hill, the backside of the Common. But of course, the true West begins with the western state lines of Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, Iowa, and Minnesota. It's a line as close to straight as you could hope to find, that runs from the Gulf of Mexico to Canada. Fewer than 100 miles from the geographical east-west division of the continental states, it lies close to the 100th meridian, the 20-inch rainfall line, and the 2,000-foot contour line, all of which various geographers recognize as demarcations between east and west. When you stand east of those states, you're in the east. Cross over, and you're in the west. It's simple and clear. I'm an authority because my family lives 200 feet from where this line passes through Kansas City. I've hit numerous backyard home runs from the east into the west. Kansas City, Missouri, is the last eastern city, and Kansas City, Kansas, the two divided only by hedges, a street, a piece of river, is the first western one. The land west of this line used to be known as the Great American Desert, but only geographers use that term now, as far as I can tell. By desert, they mean a high land, 2,000 feet and up, commonly arid, less than 20 inches rainfall, with mountains, evergreen forests, prairie grasses, and even some sand. They don't mean trackless Saharan dunes and palmy oases. The true West differs from the East in one great, pervasive, influential, and awesome way. Space. The vast openness changes the roads, towns, houses, farms, crops, machinery, politics, economics, and naturally, ways of thinking. How could it do otherwise? Space west of the line is perceptible and often palpable, especially when it appears empty. And it's that apparent emptiness which makes matter look alone, exiled, and unconnected. Those spaces diminish man and reduce his blindness to the immensity of the universe. They push him toward a greater reliance on himself, and at the same time to a greater awareness of others and what they do. But as the space diminishes man and his constructions in a material fashion, it also, paradoxically, makes them more noticeable. Things show up out here. No one, not even the sojourner, escapes the expanses. You can't get away from them by rolling up the safety glass and speeding through, because the terrible distances eat up speed. Even dawn takes nearly an hour just across Texas. Still, drivers race along. But when you get down to it, they are people uneasy about space. On the west side of the Sabine River, the land became hilly and green with deciduous trees and open in a way Louisiana was not. The long horizon gave a sense of flatness, but in truth, it was only a compression through distance of broad-topped hills. The towns, Carthage, Mount Enterprise, Old Nacogdoches, not to be confused with Old Natchitoches, Louisiana. Nacogdoches sounds as it looks, but Natchitoches comes out Natchitoches. Alto, on Texas 21 and about an hour west of the Great Line, was a pure western town. Streets broad and at right angles, canopies over sidewalks, false front stores, the commercial section a single long street rather than a cluster around a confluence of streets. And the businesses tended in one manner or another toward ranching and lumbering. To drive Blue Highway 21 is to follow Texas history. Older than the mind of man, it started as a bison trail. Buffalo walk in surprisingly straight lines. Then Indians came up it to hunt the buffalo. In 1691, Spain established a 1,000-mile Camino Real, a royal road, that would link San Antonio with Mexico, French Louisiana, and Spanish Florida. The Spaniards figured the Indians knew best, and marked their course over the old track. Often the Camino was only a direction. Up it came adventurers, padres, traders, smugglers, armies, settlers. And so it was that wandering bison, in a time even before red men came to East Texas, laid down a route that a nation whose explorers steer tangents past the planetary arcs still follow. And all travelers coming in season see the orange and red knobs of Indian paintbrush blow in the spring winds. Signboards. New Boggy Baptist Church. New Energy Baptist Church. Yard Eggs. I stopped for that one. A disfigured dog, ancestral bloodline so crossed it looked like the first dog on Earth, took up a crouch at the van door and gave a long, low, ugly snarl. A woman, shrunken into odd angles, her fingers wrung into arthritic claws, came from the house. With a swing of her cane, she sent the son of a bitch howling. She pushed her old head up to the window. Had her face been cut from cloth, it would have been in tatters. "You the television repair feller?" Like a curtain opening, the tatters drew back in a smile. "I'd like to buy some eggs."
"Oh."
The tatters dropped.
"You see, my layers fell sick over winter, and I got no extras for sale."
The dog had crept back into growling range.
"Sure you ain't the television feller? This looks like one of them repair trucks. Don't let the muck cur scare your bones."
I assured her it didn't, and never took my eyes off the mongrel as it growled me back to the road. But my loneliness fell away after seeing hers. The sky turned the color of chimney soot, A massive, squared mound, quite unlike the surrounding hills, rose from a level valley. It had been the central element in a Kadoan Indian village 1,000 years ago. I took a sandwich and climbed to the top to eat in the low overgrowth of wild blackberry bushes. There I was, a resident from the age of lunch meat, no lead, and Ziploc bags, sitting on a 1,000-year-old civic center. The aura of time the mound gave off seemed to mock any comprehension of its change and process. How it had grown from baskets of shoveled soil to the high center of Kadoan affairs to a hilly patch of blackberries. My rambling metaphysics was getting caught in the trap of reducing experience to coherence and meaning, letting the perplexity of things disrupt the joy in their mystery. To insist that diligent thought would bring an understanding of change was to limit life to the comprehensible. A raw scorch of lightning, fire from a thunderbird's eye, struck at the black clouds. A long peal. Before the rumble stopped, raindrops bashed the blackberry blossoms, and I ran for ghost dancing. Warm and dry, I watched the storm batter the old mound as it worked to wash the hill level again. The wind turned leaves white side up and bent small trees into boughs and snapped them like buggy whips, and thunder sounded like shivered timbers. It was a fine, loud, fulminating, cracking storm. When it passed, I went back up to see what I'd missed. Later, on the way down, I saw in the bushes a great white rump. A woman crapping. Along the road, a black girl sat beside a window van, hands between her knees, a cigarette between her lips. I asked how she liked the Indian mound. She lifted her hands, both of them, to pull the cigarette away. She was handcuffed.
"What mound?"
The woman in the bushes returned.
"Get in, Karen. I gotta go, too. How you gonna wipe in cuffs?"
The black girl looked at me.
"Hit the dock on the head and take me with you. Don't mess, Charlie, or you'll be sorry."
They drove off. I left and went through North Zulch on the way to College Station. I had witnessed an hour in the history of the Kadoan Mound. Black Elk, looking down on the whole hoop of the world from Harney Peak, understood more than he saw. For me, it was the other way. 2. Dime Box, Texas, is not the funniest town name in America. Traditionally, the honor belongs to Intercourse, Pennsylvania. I prefer Scratch Ankle, Alabama, Gnawbone, Indiana, or even Hump Tulips, Washington. Nevertheless, Dime Box as a name caught my ear, so that's where I headed the next morning out of College Station. In the humid night, the inside windows had dripped like cavern walls. Along State 21, I opened up and let warm air blow out the damp. West of the Brazos, the land unfolded even farther to the blue sky. Now the horizon wasn't 10 or 15 miles away, it was 30 or 40. On telephone wires sat scissor-tailed flycatchers, their oddly long tails hanging under them like stilts. Roadside wildflowers, bluebonnets, purple winecups, evening primroses, and more were abundant as crops. And where wide reaches of bluebonnets, once called buffalo clover, wolfflower, and by the Spanish, the rabbit, covered the slopes, their scent filled the highway. To all the land was an intense clarity, as if the little things gave off light. Across the Jegua River, a sign pointed south to Dime Box. Over broad hills, over the green expansion spreading under cedars and live oaks, on into a valley where I found Dime Box, essentially a three-street town. Vegetable gardens and flower beds lay to the side, behind, and in front of the houses. Perpendicular to the highway, two streets ran east and west, one of worn brick buildings facing the Southern Pacific tracks, the other a double row of false front stores and wooden sidewalks. Disregarding a jarring new bank, Dime Box could have been an MGM backlot set for a Western. You can't walk down a board sidewalk without clomping, so I clomped down to Avcharik's Cafe and through the screen door, which banged shut as they always do. An aroma of ham and beans. four calendars. From long cords, three naked bulbs burned, and still the place was dim. Everything was wood except a heating stove and a Coca-Cola cooler. Near the door, a sign tacked above the fly swatter and next to the machete explained the 10-year prison term for carrying a weapon onto premises where liquor is served. At the counter, I drank a Royal Crown. The waitress dropped my quarter into the cash register, a King Edward cigar box. Forks and knives clinked on plates behind a partition at the rear. It was too much. I ordered a dinner. She set down a long plate of ham, beans, beets, and brown gravy. I seasoned everything with hot peppers and vinegar. From the partition came a thump-thump, like an empty beer bottle rapping on a table. The waitress pulled two Lone Stars from the faded cooler, foam trickling over her fingers as she carried them back. In all the time I was there, I heard a voice from the rear only once. "I'm telling you, he can flat-out throw that ball." A man came from the kitchen, sat beside me, and began dropping toothpicks through the small openings of Tabasco sauce bottles used as dispensers. Down the counter, a fellow with tarnished eyes said, "Is it Tuesday?" The waitress nodded, and everything fell quiet again but for the clinking of forks. After a while, a single thump, and she carried back a single Lone Star. The screen door opened. A woman, old and tall, stepped into the dimness cane first, thwacking it to and fro. Loudly she croaked, "Can't see, damn it!" A middle-aged woman said, "Straight on, Mother. It isn't that dark." She helped the crone sit at one of the tables. They ordered the meal. "Ain't no use," the waitress said. "Just sold the last plate to him." Him was me. They turned and looked. "Let's go, Mother." The tall woman rose, breaking wind as she did. "Easy, Mother."
"You don't feed me proper,"
she croaked and thwacked out the door. The man with the Tabasco bottles said to no one in particular, "Don't believe the old gal needed any beans." Again, a long quiet. Then the one who had ascertained the day said to the waitress, "Saw a cat run over on the highway. Was it yourn?" She shifted the toothpick with her tongue. "What color?" He couldn't remember. "Lost me an orange cat. Ain't seen Pee-wee in a week." "I got me too many cats," he said. "I'd pay anybody a quarter each to kill my spares." That stirred a conversation on methods of putting away kittens, and that led to methods of killing fire ants. The man beside me put down a toothpick bottle. It had taken some time to fill. He said, "I've got the best way to kill fire ants, and it ain't by digging or poison." No one paid attention. Finally, he muttered, "Pour gasoline into the hive." No one said anything. "Do you light it?" I asked.
"Light what?"
"The gasoline."
"Hell no. You don't light it."
He held out a big, gullied palm and pointed to a tiny lump.
"Got nipped there last year by fire ant. If you don't pick the poison out, it leaves a knot for 2 or 3 years.
The other man talked of an uncle who once kept sugar ants in his pantry and fed them molasses.
"When they fattened up, he put them on a butter sandwich. Butter kept them from running off the bread."
The place was so quiet you could almost hear the heat on the tin roof. If anyone was listening to him, I couldn't tell.
"Claim molasses gave them ants real flavor," he said.
Thump, thump. The woman turned from the small window, her eyes vacant, and went to the cooler for two more bottles of Lone Star. I walked to the post office for stamps. The postmistress explained the town name. A century ago, the custom was to drop a letter and 10 cents for postage into the pickup box. That was an old dime box up on the San Antonio Road, now Texas 21. What happened to old dime box?
"A couple houses there yet," she said. "But the railroad came through in 1913, 3 miles south, so they moved the town to the tracks, to here. Now the train's about gone. Some freights, but that's it."
I see check names on stores.
We are between Giddings and Caldwell. Giddings is mostly German, and Caldwell's mostly Czech. We're close to 50-50. Whites, that is. A third of Dimebox is black people.
How do the different groups get along?
Pretty well. We had a to-do in the 60s over integration, but it was mostly between white groups arguing about who had the right to run the schools. Some parents bussed kids away for a spell, but that was just anger.
Bussing in Dimebox?
City people don't think anything important happens in a place like Dimebox. And usually it doesn't, unless you call conflict important, or love, or babies, or dying.
3. The big bass had a pair of horns, and beneath it the barber of Dimebox dozed in his chair. He woke when I stopped in front of the long open windows to look at the trophy on his wall.
"Texas bull bass," he said. "More bull than bass."
It was so craftily assembled I couldn't see how he'd done it.
"I caught the fish and mounted it to the steer horns. Kids come in to stare. Spooks them. Don't know why nature never put horns on a fish."
"Or fins on a longhorn?" I needed a trim. "Just nip the ends."
"One of them no-ears cuts. Took an ear off a week back. Didn't see it."
I trusted that was a joke. I hadn't paid $1.50 for a haircut in a decade. The old clock in Claude Tyler's barbershop had stopped at 2:10, and in the center of the room stood an iron wood stove, now assisted by a small gas one. Above the sink were bottles of Lucky Tiger hair tonic. I'd forgotten about tonics.
"Well, you hail from, bub,"
he said. "Same place your Lucky Tiger's made." He stepped away from the chair to look me over closely.
"Ever know a fella named Wendell Thompson from up in Missouri? Called him Hop?"
I said I didn't. Several other times he asked if I knew so-and-so from up my way, each time giving the moniker Beep, Cherry, Pard, Tin Butt.
"Hop lived in the county a while. I and him was in the Fox and Wolf Hunters Association. Now that was a bunch of fellers. I had a history of the association. Plum interesting. The mother-in-law burned it up."
He took from the wall a framed panoramic photograph of a group of men in hunting garb and laid it across my lap. The picture was a good 3 feet long, and there must have been 100 men standing or kneeling in a field, with a beagle here and about.
"Can you find me?"
I tried 4 or 5 times. I think it disheartened him that I couldn't recognize a younger Tyler.
"Have I changed that much?"
He pointed himself out, and then brought a worn copy of a Texas hunting magazine with several photographs of men around campfires. I looked carefully and took a chance.
"Hell, that's Raymond Mueller. Called him Dipper. This one's me."
I see it now. How could I miss it? Got a bad eye.
"Hooey. That's before I started fading away. I had an aneurysm removed, and I just ain't the man I was. I can abide that, but take you. You're a stranger, and all you see is a 76-year-old man. I wasn't always like this. That's what hurts. People forget what you've been."
He stepped away from the chair again.
"Listen to me. I used to cut hair and press suits all day, then go out and hunt half the night. Now I just talk a big stick. Only thing that don't run down is your mouth."
"What's that about pressing suits?"
"Come here."
I followed him to a small back room, the striped chair cloth still around my neck, hair half cut. He pointed to an old steam press.
"Sold the dry cleaning machine, but there's where I put 1 million creases and paints. Started in 1925. Feller would come in for a shave, haircut, and suit pressing, all for 35 cents. This was as good a shop as any in Texas, and I did a business. Listened to 1 million stories cutting those old squirrels' heads. Barber's the third most lied to person, you know."
"Who's first?"
"Man's wife is first anywhere in the world. Priest is second."
We went back to the chair, and he took more snips.
"Used to barber across the street, west of Sonny's. Ought to go see the rattlesnake skins in there."
He motioned south, and for a moment I thought I would have to cross the street with a half-cut head to look at Sonny's rattlesnakes.
Been in this shop since the 40s. Built it myself. How many barbers left that built their own shops?
Saw some figures on it. I think it was 3, not counting you. Tyler smiled.
Come here.
I followed him to the side window, where a big cottonwood grew from under the edge of the wooden building. It had started to lift the floor.
Trees old as the shop. Cut it down once a year for 6 years. Finally gave up. I'll be gone before it turns the place over. Filled in that west side with river sand when I built the shop. Must have took in a seed.
We went back to the chair.
Gotten old watching that tree grow. It's so cussed fixed on making its way. I've thought about pulling the shop down to give it room. Kind of living memorial to shade tree barbering. Ain't much need of a barber shop in Dimebox now. People get out to the bigger towns anymore.
A lot of small towns are coming back.
Could happen to us. They located a big pool of oil here, deep oil, way down. Feller picked up some land for back taxes, turned around and discovered oil. Now people believe oil's gonna bring things back like they used to be. I say hoping's swell, but better be ready for it to go as fast as it comes. Who listens? People thought the railroad wouldn't ever play out neither. That's why they moved the town here. We used to say there'd always be the railroad. You could count on it because it don't depend on weather, and weevils don't eat steel. Well, bub, how'd you like our depot?
I haven't seen it.
Tore down, that's why. But Model T's used to line up all along the road to the depot. Cars, trains, girls in big hats. Dimebox made noise then.
Freights still come through, don't they?
Can't live off a toot and a whistle unless you can eat steam. Hell, it ain't even steam anymore. We get on now with ranching, farming, people stopping off on the way to the artificial lake.
Artificial? I imagined a giant plastic pond, the height of Disney World fool-the-eye stuff.
Lake Somerville, one of those damn lakes.
He whisked away the hair with his little white brush.
Before the cattle business got big in here, we used to grow cotton, even had a gin. All gone. When I was a whippersnapper, I used to look at the cotton fields and wonder which bowl would end up in my shirt. Now shirts are this polyester made from oil. But I reckon when we go to pumping oil, Dimebox will be back in the shirt business, and they'll call that progress.
He started to dress me down with Lucky Tiger. Leave it dry if you would.
You young fellers take all the fun out of barbering. I'd have got run out of town 30 years ago for a haircut like that.
To me, it was the best haircut I ever got in Dimebox, Texas. 4. The wooden floor creaked, the bar warped in the middle. The rattlesnake skins, nailed to the wall, and the stuffed bobcat and deer trophy heads all looked parched. Even the ceiling supports, peeled cedar trunks with lopped branches, had split in the dry Texas air. In Sonny's place was a dusty upright piano, dusty because the entertainment at Sonny's wasn't music. It was dominoes. Of the 6 domino tables, each with a complement of worn tiles, only the one nearest the bar had a game that afternoon. A man in a yellow cap that said cat twice announced he was playing his last round. He said it before the first last game and again before the second last game. A large old fellow walked in, greeted everyone, sat at the bar, ordered a glass of pearl, drank it off in 2 tilts, licked the foam from his upper lip, looked at me, gave a smile that pinned his great jowls to his ears, and said,
"Good."
I nodded. He watched me, and I could tell he was getting ready to ask in his own manner for my version of the human saga. As if playing in an old western, he actually said,
"What brings you to Dimebox?"
I told him I was on a long motor tour, but he was a little hard of hearing, and I had to repeat twice to get the right volume. The whole tavern turned to ears. Perhaps the old gentleman pretended hearing problems in order to share stories with everyone. After all, New story was a thing of value in Sonny's. I felt like a radio, but I got used to the little audience at the domino table. The man's name was, as I understood it, Mr. Valka, and he'd been born in Dimebox in the last century. Some voices I'd heard in town carried slight old-world accents, but his was pronounced. All W's came out as V's, and his lips had never known the sound of TH. His parents had emigrated from Czechoslovakia, and he learned English only after beginning school. He reminisced about his Slavic past.
In the Great War against the Germans, you remember the Americans fight with the Poles and Russians against the evil, he said. Here was me, a poor boy from Dimebox, Texas, talking with the foreign soldiers in their language. The city boys, Chicago and Cleveland, even they was amazed. These Slavs all understand each other. Oh, we have some good times, me and those Slavs. We play cards, not the dominoes, and we drink the slivovitz. That was a war.
Once he had been a clothing merchant.
But I might have done other things, too.
He drank a second beer, this one more slowly.
Are you a philosopher?
Too dangerous. That's a hard hat area.
Never mind, said. I give you a simple problem. On the floor, I put down three things. Rifle, hole, fishing rod and reel. Take one and live only by it for 1 year, alone. Which do you take?
While I thought, a man wearing a Coors t-shirt came in. Everyone said in turn, Hello, Father. He was the priest of Dimebox. Straddling a chair, resting his arms on the back, drinking an orange soda pop, he watched the domino game. The man, Cat, said it was his last round. The wife would wonder.
You take so long to answer. You must be philosophical. I tell you this, you won't choose a rifle.
How do you know?
Hunters make decisions fast, like a bullet. Ping.
Okay, I'll take the rod and reel.
Now fire set.
You didn't say anything about ammunition, and I'd die before crops came up. I can make hooks and line and eat immediately.
Ah, a man's answer shows him.
Which would you take? It was the question he was waiting for.
Me? I takes a rifle.
A domino player said,
All you ever shot was the breeze. No? No, you say? Well, I think about it for 80 years, and you don't know about the war. I shot the Germans left and right, mows them down like hay.
Everyone in the bar, some with slight German accents, laughed. To me, he said,
They think I only can sell pens.
To the room, he said,
I tell you, the muzzle was hot like a poker, except on weekends, because then we drink the slivovitz.
They all laughed again. When I left Sonny's, the game, like a potato cell, had subdivided into two identical ones, and the little tiles fell softly on the old tables, and the man Cat was playing his last game. After all, the wife would wonder. 5. At Austin, on a hill west of the Colorado River, not the Colorado River, but the one flowing from near the New Mexico line to the Gulf, the desert began. Desert as in dry, rocky, vast. There was nothing gradual about the change. It was sudden and clear. Within a mile or so, the bluebonnets vanished, as if evaporated. The soil turned tan and granular, and squatty trees got squattier with each mile, as if reluctant to reach too far from their deep, wet taproots. Highway 290, running from rim rock to rim rock of the Edwards Plateau, climbed, dropped a little, climbed again, until I was 1,200 feet higher than Dimebox. From the tops of the tableland, I could watch empty roadway reaching for miles to the scimitar of a horizon visible at every compass point. It was fine to see the curving edge of the old blue ball of a world. Johnson City was truly a plain town. The Lyndon B. Johnson boyhood home, pleasantly plain, is here, and commercial buildings on the square were plain and homely. The best piece, the refurbished Johnson City Bank of rough-cut fieldstone, was perhaps the only bank in the country to be restored rather than bulldozed for a French provincial Tudor hacienda time and temperature building. The road went directly into a sunset that could have been a J.M.W. Turner painting. Colors, texture, the horizontal composition were his. I'd never thought Turner a realist. The land, now cattle and peach country, wasn't so rocky and dry as the great ridges I'd just crossed. West of Stonewall, I saw the last of dusk, and under a big desert night, I drove in the small coziness of my headlamps until Sonny's beer made me stop. While I stood, an uncommon amount of noise came invisibly through the brush. Whatever it was, I felt vulnerable and tried to hurry. The moonlight wasn't much, but what I could make out looked like a tiptoeing army helmet. I was moving backwards when I realized it was an armadillo. I stopped. It waddled on, sniffed me out at the last moment, and shifted direction without hurry. The conquistadors named the armadillo Little Armored One, but Texans called them diggers because of the animal's penchant for scratching up larvae and worms, especially from soft soil of new graves. In spite of both the belief that armadillos feed on corpses and the animal's susceptibility to leprosy, poor whites ate them with greens and cornbread during the Depression and called them Hoover hogs or Texas turkeys on the Christmas table. Even now, poor blacks, calling them just dillas, barbecue the soft meat. Ancient Mayas refused to eat them because they believed the carrion vulture did not die but rather shed wings and metamorphosed into an armadillo. But now, for a creature hardly changed from its Cenozoic ancestors, things are a little better. Texas law protects it from commercial exploitation, and that means it's harder today to buy a lamp or purse made from an armadillo carapace. When I got back to my rig, the critter was nosing along the highway looking for bugs popped by cars. That's why in the warm season so many armadillos get pressed like fossils into the soft asphalt. I honked it back to cover and drove into Fredericksburg, where I parked for the night behind the old Gillespie County Courthouse and went looking for calendars on cafe walls. The only eatery open was a big laminated place called the Hofhaus or Meisterhof or Braumeister, something like that. Having to order by number, I knew I was in for it. I chose number whatever, which proved to be three gray sausage corpses in a nest of sauerkraut that squeaked like rubber bands as I chewed, and Bavarian potato salad dissolved into a post-factory slurry. I would have been better off with barbecued Hoover hog. 6. History has a way of taking the merely curious and turning it into significance. Consider the old Nimitz Hotel in Fredericksburg, for example. Not the rebuilt Nimitz Hotel I saw, but the 1852 version. A German immigrant, Charles H. Nimitz, knowing the value of distinctive architecture, in 1880 built on his hotel, which had long afforded some protection from the Comanches, an addition shaped like a steamboat with a prow thrusting into the bounty of Main Street. The place with hurricane deck, pilot house, and crow's nest was unique, and the food toothsome. Nimitz had a good trade, once including Robert E. Lee, who slept in a spool bed here. Charles Nimitz was the grandfather of the commander-in-chief of the United States Pacific Fleet in the Second World War, Chester W. Nimitz. The only thing resembling a ship young Nimitz saw on the Texas plains was the steamboat hotel, and all he knew of the sea, not counting the marine fossils in the native limestone, were his grandfather's stories about the German merchant fleet. No wonder Chester, in his first command at sea, ran his destroyer aground and got court-martialed. That was natural for a boy who grew up steering a hotel across the prairie. Nevertheless, this son of the great American desert later directed the victory in the largest naval war ever fought. I didn't hear anyone in town offer a theory on the role that old Charlie Nimitz's ship hotel played in determining the outcome of World War II, but somebody will think of it sooner or later. For all I know, Main Street in Fredericksburg is the widest in the nation. It was so broad, I had to make a point of remembering why I was crossing to keep from forgetting by the time I reached the other side. And it was broad not for a few blocks, but for 2 miles. Settlers from the compacted villages of the Rhine Valley laid Main out to enable ox carts to turn around in it.